once you have your first raise under your belt, it actually gets exponentially easier with every time. And then the more you're able to put into place different systems and different processes, it actually streamlines raising capital significantly. And so I always tell people that I don't raise capital when I have a deal on the table. I raise capital in between my deals.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Vina Jetty is the founding partner of Vive Fund. She's based in Dallas, Texas. They are doing all sorts of amazing things. And I'm excited to have Vina on the show today. They've just recently closed an enormous transaction just outside of Atlanta. They've got an enormous fund as well that they are raising for right now and are really just rocking it in the real estate space. So Vina, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
The pleasure's mine. Hey, same three questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. Can you quickly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yes. I don't know how quickly I can do it, but I'm going to do my best.
90 seconds or less.
All right. So where did I start? I come from a real estate family. So my mom was a successful real estate investor, not quite at this scale that I'm at right now, but she is the one who really gave me my roots in real estate investing and my foundation. Graduated undergrad when I was 20 with my degree in finance, went into corporate America, made a bunch of money for other people, ultimately left one of the large real estate investment firms in DC in 2012 to start investing for myself and continued to scale up from there. And so now we are a large multifamily owner operator. We target assets that are 200 units and up in our core markets. And we specifically focus on value-add assets, either through operational efficiencies or value-add to interior renovations, exterior renovations, preferably some combination. And how I got here was honestly persistence. I think just continuing to be persistent about how we can improve our craft and get better every time we do a deal. I learn from it and I actually improve my process. Even with the latest deal that we closed, I've learned so much from that. And now I've improved the process so that the next time is better. So
wow. That's a lot of moving pieces there in just a few short years. I love the idea of persistence, right? What have been some times really that make you think you go, okay, that was a time that I really had to push through?
Like every deal I've ever closed, from the smallest one to the most recent. Because, you know, the thing is, everyone feels like it should be rinse and repeat once you've done it so many times. But you and I both know it never is. There's always a surprise and you're always adjusting. I will say the last couple of closings we've had have been very smooth transitions. But there's always something we learn. We do, you know, a post-close kind of team huddle and see what we did right, what we did wrong, what we can do better, what things we want to add into our process. I make a lot of notes, especially around our PSA. So how can we make that better for the next time?
Notes on your purchase and sale agreement, how that can be better?
Yeah. So there's actually a lot of things that you can put into a PSA, either as a buyer or seller, or things that you can word in a certain way. An example, right, would be around publicity around your deal. So in the past, we had closed a deal where we had agreed that we would not publicly announce the purchase price or the seller or the deal itself, which when we're doing 506C raises, it makes it more challenging to not be able to advertise the deal that you're raising for. And so one of the things, the changes we've made is now we kind of look at that a little more closely to make sure we're not violating the terms of our PSA. But when we're on the seller side, we like to control that information going out. For what it's worth, we like to say, okay, you can disclose this information, and this information, but you have to get approval to disclose anything else for 90 days post-close or whatever that looks like. So we started paying attention to those little nuances in our PSA itself.
Let's spend a minute here. Let's get maybe mechanical on this today and dig in a little bit because I want to hear more on this. What are the differences on the buy and the sell side, the pieces of information you want to control and why?
Well, in this market, right, we're really in a seller's market still in the multifamily arena. So you can mostly dictate the terms of this pretty broadly. But the buyer, especially because we raise our funds from retail capital. So I have an investor who hears me on a podcast or meets me at a conference who wants to invest with us. And they might not know that there's a deal available unless they see it on my social media, right? Like my Instagram or whatever. But when you can't talk about it during the inspection period or doing due diligence, it limits my ability to connect with new investors. Luckily, our database is very strong. So we have a lot of current and repeat investors that it's not a big issue, but for a newer investor, it could be a huge problem. So on the buy side, you want to make sure that whatever your marketing plan is to raise your capital, that you're able to disclose the details accordingly or take the traffic from your different media sources and direct it in the right place. So that's what you want to look at on the buy side. On the sell side, you may want to control that because you might have investors in the deal that you want to make sure you're the first to tell them, hey, this asset is selling or it's sold. You want to make sure maybe that they're not getting this information from somebody else. Another example would be, I don't necessarily want to be selling an asset and then have a buyer go out and say, oh, it was completely mismanaged and here's all the opportunity on it, right? Because if there's overlap, it does not look good for you as the seller, even if you're hitting your price point. So I think that from the sell side, your incentive is a little bit different in how you are trying to control that narrative. And as a buyer, really the focus is around being able to raise the capital or bring in the capital that you need.
Right. Yeah, that's very interesting. And I wouldn't have thought about either one of those. And now that you mentioned, I've often wondered why sometimes I was assumed it was a 506B deal or something, you know, like, well, we can't really talk, you know, we're kind of just, you know, this is, we can't talk about it on the show, but maybe it is because they are restricted under terms of the purchase and sale agreement.
It probably is that it is a 506B. So we do 506C raises. So it's especially important for us to be able to speak about our deals.
Otherwise, it kind of negates half the value in a 506C raise.
Exactly. Then we might as well do a 506B, and it's a lot less of a threshold to verify accreditation. But yeah, so in a 506B, it makes sense. But it could be that they can't talk about it per their PSA, or it could be that they're just limited in what they can say about their deal.
Right. Oh, that's really interesting. You said you guys focused on 200 units and up. I've heard 100 and up. How did you pick 200?
Because it's like the minimum amount we will look at. We have a very strong preference to 300 and up. So it's like the bare minimum of what we would look at in our market. Really, it comes down to the ability for us to scale, to be able to realize operational efficiencies and to have enough movement, or I guess pivot ability, in our core market. So right now in Atlanta, we have about $250 million in assets that we've closed on in the last 14 months. And so that gives us an ability to really maximize the efficiency across the asset. So for example, our landscaping contracts are cheaper than when we had just one asset. And so we find that that sweet spot is between like 70 and 100, 110, 120 million for us to be able to capitalize the deal comfortably, be able to guarantee the deal, close it, and operate it efficiently in our portfolio.
Gotcha. That's very, very interesting. How do you guys, because once you get into the big leagues, especially at 300 units and up, you're playing with the institutional players. What's your competitive edge in that space?
It's really tough because we're not competing on price right now. We are competing on terms. So because we are private placement, we have the ability to be very agile with our capital and we can stack it very efficiently. So as an example, the last deal that we won, we closed it in 42 days with no extensions, which is very, very fast, put us under a lot of pressure, especially during the holidays. It's a really tough time to have capital right now coming in. But I think that being able to be flexible on things like that, being able to put money hard day one, we don't have the same red tape that institutional funds typically will have. And so because we're the ones controlling the deals, we can oftentimes green light something very quickly. We can move fast. I think the other thing too is we're all of the sponsors on our deal are young. And so a lot of the sellers want to transact with us again, and they know that this isn't the first or only deal that they're going to do with us. They're going to do many deals and there's a long horizon in front of us.
Right. That's absolutely fascinating. When you say stack capital efficiently, what does that mean?
Yeah. So we can go in and we can alter how we structure our payments, right? So we actually tend to stick to a very vanilla, boring structure, but we have the ability to adjust those as needed. So maybe in a certain situation, I would have to defer part of an acquisition fee till the exit of a deal or waive it altogether. So those are things that we can do. We don't have mandates where we have to follow, like, this is always the acquisition fee. So we can make sure we're taking care of our investors first and the deal's still working. And then, you know, we get paid along the way when we perform.
Right. That's absolutely fabulous. Talk to us about your fund. What has been the most surprising thing you've discovered as you've launched and are growing your fund?
Oh gosh, there's like new surprising things. Like every week there's something new. I'm like, huh, didn't think about it that way, but okay, makes sense. But I think the one most surprising thing that's happened is, so I'm very in tune with my investors. I like to know them very personally. I like to know what their criteria is, what their avatar is. And one thing I totally did not expect is when we launched our fund, so our assets, we offer direct investment and investment through our fund. For us, it doesn't matter where they come from because we don't double fee. And so it's really investors' preference on it. And what I found was a lot of investors invested into the fund as kind of their like routine investment. So every quarter they set aside X dollars, or every 6 months they set aside X dollars to invest in Rev Fund. But then when we put an asset out that's going into the fund, I saw them invest into Rev and then also directly into the asset, which I did not expect at all. But the reason they were doing it is because they wanted the diversification of the fund. But then they were like, oh, but I really like this one asset because of the year of construction, or I have extra funds this month, or I want to bet heavier on this asset than just through the fund diversification. So that was something that totally took me aback. I mean, I get it. I personally prefer to invest directly into each asset, but I understand why someone wants just kind of the set it and forget it mindset, wants to do Rev Fund and then add individual investments as they like deals that go into our fund.
What are some downsides to someone from a limited partner perspective? What are some downsides of a fund versus a direct investment?
So I think it's the same thing that's the pro is also the con. It's controlling where your funds are going and what you're invested into. So if you're somebody that likes to choose direct investments, you don't necessarily get that opportunity. And if you want to choose your allocation within each asset, you don't get that opportunity with Rev. So it's really up to you what your portfolio looks like, what it calls for.
Wow, that's absolutely fascinating. Take us back, maybe all the way back to the first deal. What was it like getting that deal, getting your capital? And just talk to us about the capital raise journey. That's a common thing that people talk about. And it seems like you've got it kind of figured out at this point. So talk to us about that process.
Yeah, it was really hard. It was really, 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 really hard. And I feel like people, especially now in our world, like they talk about like, oh yeah, we'll just raise some capital because there's a lot of people raising capital right now. But it was so hard. I think I cried myself to sleep for like 6 weeks straight thinking that I just put everything at risk. We had all this hard money we were going to lose. We weren't going to close the deal. No one wanted to write me a check. And I remember at one point I went to my husband, I was like, honey, we're going to have to sell everything we own. We're going to have to liquidate all of the retirement savings. I have to sell your car. And he's like, whoa, what is happening right now? And I was like, I need $1.2 million in 30 days and I don't have that. And he was like, okay, well, let's talk about this more because he's not involved in real estate. So he didn't know. And so that was kind of how the first experience, but what I will say I learned from that is once you have your first raise under your belt, it actually gets exponentially easier with every time. And then the more you're able to put into place different systems and different processes, it actually streamlines raising capital significantly. And so I always tell people that I don't raise capital when I have a deal on the table. I raise capital in between my deals because you simply don't have enough time to get to know an investor. It's a trust business, right? They need to know who you are. They need to know why they should invest with you, what your deals typically look like. So now that I don't have a deal that's actively in process of closing, now is when I actually will raise the vast majority of my capital. So by the time I have a deal, all they're doing is they're vetting the deal itself and the returns of the deal for their portfolio.
Right. That makes a heck of a lot of sense. But a painful lesson, I want to circle back to how you got the 1.2. But, you know, that many people have learned. I was at a conference yesterday and there was someone there and they're like, well, I need X more dollars by this date. And I just kind of said, yeah, you could just tell. I'm like, good luck. I doubt you're going to make it. Good luck, because your timeline is ticking and I can just tell with the tenacity which you're attacking this that it's just not going to get done. So tell us, how did you not sell the house and your husband's cars? And
yeah, we were like this close. So I actually really tapped into my network in a way that I was very uncomfortable doing on the first raise, because I'm asking someone to trust me without having ever raised capital before or ever having investor capital. I will say a significant portion of it was investors that prior to me going out and officially trying to raise capital had said, hey, can you teach me how to do this on the weekend? And I was like, well, no, because I work 100 hours a week and you do that at whatever profession, busy doctor. And then they would say, okay, I'll just write you a check and then you invest my money where you invest your money and I'll just invest alongside of you. And so actually, those were some of the people I had to go back to. I spoke to them. And on the first deal, we structured it very investor friendly. There were not a whole lot of fees, promotes, any of that involved in our first deal. because we just could not afford to do it, mainly because we needed investors to write us a check. And so we had to make sure that our interests were really aligned correctly. So ultimately, I reached back into relationships that I had that I wasn't initially going to approach, and went to them and said, hey, listen, give me a shot, you know, test it out, put in a small amount, whatever that is, 25, 50,000, and then let me show you what we can do. And now I actually, the KPI I track the most is average size of investment, but also more importantly than that is how many investors repeat invest with me. I care about that the most. So I don't care if someone's investing $50,000, but I want them to invest a second time because I want that long-term relationship.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That's great. Vina, I've learned so much today. Thanks for taking the time to kind of pull back the curtains on your business, what you guys do, how you do it. Congrats on getting this latest $81.5 million deal in Atlanta across the finish line. That's awesome. Lots of things for our listeners to aspire to here. Let's jump into the final four questions. The first one is this: what is one tool or resource you find you can't live without?
Oh gosh, my laptop and my cell phone. Oh, that's two. I mean, I just need to be connected at all times for my business.
Got it. That is great. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
I think in the theme of raising capital, right? It's don't wait till you have a deal to raise capital. Make those connections now, make that network now, especially if you're doing a 506B raise, because you need to establish a substantive relationship before the deal is on the table. So make sure you understand your SEC rules and then go out and raise that capital before you have a deal.
Right. Absolutely. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
We are really big on philanthropy. So every time we close a deal, we have a tradition of choosing a charity, and usually we'll choose something meaningful to us at that time. And so I do like a second round of fundraising where I invite anybody who made money from the deal or who invested in the deal even to donate to whichever charity is the chosen one for that deal.
That's fabulous. Love it. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, they can go to my website, vivefunds.com, vivefunds.com, or you can find me on all the social media. Vina Jetty is pretty much my handle across social media.
Awesome. Vina, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.